We'll call the meeting of the March 26, 2025 meeting of the House Public Safety Meeting Committee to order. A quorum is present. Before we begin our meeting, I want to remind everyone that the committee expects proper decorum at all times. All dialogue goes through the chair. Signs are not allowed in the committee room. There will be no outburst or clapping. For safety reasons, standing or sitting in the walkways and aisles is prohibited. If accommodation is needed, communicate with the sergeant staff. Failure to comply with these guidelines may result in removal from the hearing room. Thank you to the sergeant at arm staff who were present to help maintain decorum in this committee room. Representative Coran, have you had a chance to review the meetings of the minutes of the March 25th, 2025 meeting?
I have, Chair, and I move for their approval.
Representative Coran moves to approve the March 25th, 2025 meetings. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. Motion carries and the minutes of the March 25th, 2025 meetings are approved. First bill on the agenda today is House File 1550. Chair West, please come to the testifier 1590-1590. Chair West, I see you're at the testifier's table. I will move House File 1590 before the committee. We do not have a fiscal note on your bill yet, so we will be laying it over. Chair West, please begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members of the Public Safety Committee, for hearing this bill. This is a very important bill. It's personal to me and personal to many families around the state. So, as I'm sure many of you are aware, my child was abused at a daycare last year. And been working through it, her two abusers were charged with five felonies of malicious treatment of a minor under four. That was for five different children, and there were many other potential charges from many other parents, but these five are the ones where we had pictures or video documentation. I care a lot about the camera bills I'm working on related to childcare for this specific purpose, but what we're finding is these five felonies, only two were on video, so only two are likely to stick. And then, so that was already a frustrating thing to hear from the prosecutor. Then, even though we're talking about months-long abuse of children, their first offer was 90 days. And that's assuming they can get the two that they can count. And I know lots of times you skip over written testimony when it's in there, but I have two letters in there from parents who are in the same situation I am, so in the same case. And the reason they're not here today to tell their own story is because they're at the plea acceptance hearing for their child's abuser, for my child's abuser, literally right now. And we don't know what the final settlement is. We're about to know. I'm going to know in about an hour. But the fact that it is 90 days would be the max is madness. And one thing, talking to other law enforcement, substantial experienced law enforcement officers, that they even said is we say we treat children as important as adults in crimes. But when somebody's involved in a drive-by shooting, they'll get arrested, they'll get a prison sentence, likely life, especially if they have done it before. When you have somebody take the life of an infant by shaking them, they get maybe 12 years. And so this isn't about making sure every penalty is that large, but the fact that the parents and families involved in these situations don't even come close to something that's appropriate is something that I think we can fix. And I know the left side of the aisle this is not a political bill. I know the left side of the aisle does not particularly like mandatory minimums, and I understand why. But what I would What I'd ask them is there is, so the argument's going to be this won't prevent anything. This is just about punishment. But what I'd ask is there is a factor where justice, we're getting families justice. And even, like, I know for, when I brought this bill up with the families, they wanted much more than this is 1 year. So I guess I should talk about the content of the bill. It's for malicious treatment of, malicious punishment of a child under four. If it's a felony, it's a minimum 1 year. If it's a felony with great bodily harm, it's a minimum 2 years. And if they've had a gross misdemeanor conviction of malicious treatment of a child under four, if their second gross misdemeanor is upgraded to a felony, so then it does qualify for the 1 year minimum. And this is to get justice for these families. If selfishly to get justice for my family, but honestly, it's not obvious, this won't affect my family, our case is gone. But this is incredibly important if we're gonna, like, really take issues seriously. Because you're going to have parents, like, if this ever happened again, you're going to have parents that do things that they might regret. Because if it's not even 90 days, which they don't even expect 90, I'll know in an hour or so, it's just wrong. So thank you for listening, and I am happy to take member questions.
There are no other testifiers signed up. Is there any other testifiers that you know of, Chair West?
They're busy.
Are there questions for Chair West? Representative, or Chair Moeller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Chair West, for bringing this bill. And just, I'm so sorry that that happened to your family, to your child, and appreciate you sharing your story with us. It can't be easy, and we'll take a close look at this bill, as we do with bills that are laid over. And I just, again, want to express that I'm just really sorry that that happened to your family and to the other families that you mentioned. Thank you.
Chair West, close.
I appreciate the committee's consideration. And if there's anything that can be done on this issue, I will sing your praises till the end of time. So thank you for hearing the bill, Chair Novotny.
Thank you. With that, Chair West, I'm going to lay over House File 1590. Next, we have three bills, all of which expand law enforcement use of unmanned aerial vehicles. The authors of each bill will discuss their bill, and we will hold off testimony until all three bill authors have explained their bills. Representative Quam, you have, we'll then have a delete all amendment that incorporates the additional individual additions to law enforcement use of UAVs into one bill, which will need to go to judiciary. Chair Quam, you have House File 561. I will move House File 561 before the committee. Please come to the table and explain your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this came from a discussion with local sheriffs, and they're concerned that there were restrictions or things that slowed down being able to quickly do things with drones. One is searching for missing children, vulnerable adults, especially in the wintertime. You want to be able to, as soon as you find out, it'd be nice to have a drone up and try to locate that person before they suffered some health issues from the cold. Plus, when they're warmer, they show up on the infrared. The other one was the concern that they felt they would need a warrant or some judicial order to be able to utilize it for if someone escaped. And then also they would like to be able to utilize a drone when they're pursuing a fleeing person. These last two, if there's a chase and et cetera, and you've got a drone, then you don't have to be driving quite as quickly. It makes for a much safer pursuit. And then if there's a escaped person from a jail or prison, it would make it, again, quicker, and it would also help to prevent, I guess, danger to people around. But this isn't really intended to do a big change, just allow for more cooperative language for the safety of everybody involved. I'm done now. Sorry.
Thank you, Chair Quam. I will lay over House File 561. Next House File is 1275. That's Representative Tabke. Please come to the testifiers table. Representative Tabke, would you like to move House File 1275 before the committee?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Please explain your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a bill from DPS about being able to use drones for fleeing vehicles and making sure that we're keeping folks safe. We have Mr. Drew Evans here to explain.
Superintendent Evans, begin your state your full name and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Drew Evans. I'm the superintendent of the Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. Thank you for hearing this proposal. We are bringing this forward that is related to some situations that we've encountered as we work to comply with the unmanned aerial vehicle statute that was passed in the last few years. One situation that we've encountered on a regular basis is where we have teams such as our Violent Crime Response Unit that is assisting many local jurisdictions and have a number of local jurisdictions assigned to us, where we're working to apprehend violent wanted persons in particular. In those situations, as you can imagine, some of those individuals choose to flee from us on foot as we're working in this or in a vehicle. And when that's happening, there is currently a prohibition in law and is not one of the exceptions that's allowed under the law to be able to utilize a UAV to be able to launch and be able to set a perimeter so that we're not chasing. Oftentimes what we're doing now is we have our agents and partners running through backyards, jumping fences, not able to see what's just beyond them. By utilizing a UAV, we'd be able to launch it, be able to identify where that person may be, set a perimeter, and be able to safely apprehend that person. We believe this is safer for police officers that are working day to day. We believe it's safer for the people that are being apprehended so that we don't, or that we're attempting to apprehend so that we don't have to jump over that unknown fence and place anybody in danger. So it's a fairly simple piece that we've proposed. I know there's others that you're examining in this process. This is related directly to our work, and I'd be happy to stand for any questions members may have.
As we said, questions will be at the end, so please stick around, Superintendent Evans. Representative Tabke, anything?
And Chair Novotny, I just want to make sure to note as well is that the language we have in 1275 will be slightly tweaked as it goes when we do the DE. So there's an amendment for 1396, which just changes the language from lawful pursuit of a fleeing vehicle to lawful pursuit of a suspect who is fleeing law enforcement or who the law enforcement agency reasonably believes might flee. And so that is the amended language that will be put together.
Thank you. With that, House File 1275 is laid over. Finally, Vice Chair Witte has House File 1396. Please go to the testifier table. Chair Witte, would you like to move House File 1396 before the committee with the recommendation that House File 1396 is re-referred to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee?
Yes.
Vice Chair Witte, please begin your bill.
So House File 1396, as we've been hearing, is relating to public safety, expanding the permitted use of unmanned aerial vehicles, or UAVs, by law enforcement. My bill is to prevent the imminent destruction of evidence, it adds, and then also on private area or written consent of occupant for officer training or public relations purpose. So you would get written consent. And then the last one to facilitate the search for a missing person. you know, you will, it takes a lot of time to get a helicopter, and sometimes if they're not there, this is an alternative. And as I've always said, seconds, minutes matter, and having it on scene and being able to utilize this tool can help in many different ways. I'm going to turn it over to my testifier.
Thank you for being here. Please state your full name and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Navani, members of the committee. Again, thanks for having me today. My name is Scott Habel. I'm the elected sheriff in Renville County, which is about 75 miles straight west of where we sit today. I'm here to testify in support of House File 1396. The Minnesota Sheriff's Association actually sought this bill. It aims to modernize the existing UAV law regarding UAV use by law enforcement. Passage of this bill aims to align policy with public safety needs. It does three things, as mentioned: strengthens crime scene preservation, ensures that law enforcement can quickly and effectively respond to missing persons emergencies, and thirdly, allows us to adequately train our officers and deputies to respond to these types of emergencies. So the proposed updates authorize UAV use to preserve and protect evidence from imminent destruction, allowing law enforcement to act swiftly in preserving critical information that could otherwise be lost or tampered with before search warrants could be issued. For this provision, I'd encourage you to think about outdoor crime scenes with impending weather coming, or who knows, any other situation that Mother Nature might throw at us. This bill aims not to change any evidence, but to be able to quickly and accurately document it. Secondly, as you know, UAVs are an incredibly effective way to search in time-sensitive missing persons cases. The language in this bill would grant law enforcement explicit permission to use this critical tool to locate missing individuals more quickly, thereby improving the response outcomes. And then finally, with regard to training, as you can imagine, a deputy piloting a UAV is only as good as his or her training. And so under the current law, officers and deputies can only conduct training flights over public areas. One of the unique things about my county is we have massive cornfields. Sometimes we're called to search for lost or missing kids in standing corn. A UAV with a well-trained pilot, man, what a great resource that would be in that situation. Unfortunately, though, there are no cornfields in public places. And what that means is we have quite literally no way to train our deputies for that specific scenario. So when a deputy responds to that call of the child lost in a field, if he or she were to use a UAV, it would literally be their first flight over an agricultural field. They'd have to learn as they go, rather than being well-trained and ready and experienced for that situation. So in this business, we do our best to train our officers and deputies for any situation they might encounter. Unfortunately, the current law doesn't allow us to train for this one. Similarly, from time to time, I'll have farmers call and say, Sheriff, I have some cattle. They're out in my cornfield. It's adjacent to the pasture. There's 80 acres of corn out there. There's 10 cattle that are out. I don't know exactly where they're at. Can you help me find them? Can you bring the drone out and tell me where they're at so we can find them before they make their way to a road, somebody hits them and gets hurt? Unfortunately, today, the answer is no. We can't. The law doesn't allow us to do that. So with the language in this bill, hypothetically, we get that farmer's permission, written consent, we fly over his field, we find his cattle. Not only do we find his cattle, we've just created another positive contact between law enforcement and the community that we serve. That same farmer and many others like him will most likely offer their written consent and allow us to set up training scenarios out in their cornfields that we can fly training flights. Now, when that little child goes missing in nine-foot-tall corn, we deploy a well-trained, well-experienced deputy who has searched in standing corn before. This just makes sense. The Minnesota Sheriff's Association fully supports these updates as they enhance public safety, they improve operational effectiveness, and investigative integrity, while ensuring UAV use remains clear, lawful, transparent, and accountable. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'll stand for any questions.
Thank you, Sheriff Habel. And as I said, we're going to wait on testimony until we do all three bills. There's an amendment to the DE3 amendment coded A3. The A3 amendment restructures the language of the DE3 concerning law enforcement use of drone to pursue a fleeing suspect. This amendment came from the Department of Public Safety, and it conforms to the language that was amended in the Senate.
We will move the DE3 amendment that deletes all the DE delete all amendment that incorporates the language of all three bills into one bill. There's also the amendment, as I discussed, for the DE3 amendment, the A3. All in favor of adopting the A3 amendment to the D3 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed, say nay. Motion carries. All in favor of adopting the DE3 amendment as amended, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say nay. Motion carries, and the DE3 amendment is adopted as amended. We will now have testimony on the House File 1396 and as amended. Representative Witte is up there, as and Representative Superintendent Evans, do you have anything to add as amended? I actually have questions for you, Superintendent Evans.
Thank you. That was good.
Okay. Superintendent Evans, while you're sitting there, having flown several times in the State Patrol helicopters and knowing their capabilities, is there anything that you can see on the bill as it is in its current form that allows law enforcement to do something with the drones that they could not do currently with a helicopter?
Chair Novotny and members of the committee, no, I don't see anything that would preclude that.
And Superintendent Evans, what would you say is if we have Sheriff Hobble there, Rendell County, what would be your response time if they needed a helicopter?
Chair Novotny and members of the committee, I think as was alluded to, the helicopters are, you know, stationed in different locations throughout the state, but to get to Rendell County from here would take a considerable amount of time.
All right.
And Chair Novotny, just to expand, I mean, the State Patrol helicopter is used for all types of different purposes, you know, throughout the state, and is a valuable asset to all of us in law enforcement, including the BCA. This would be a supplement to utilizing those services, because there are times it makes sense to do that. But when time is of the essence, as Sheriff Hable noted, there's nothing faster than somebody available with a drone to be able to do that.
Thank you. Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I got very confused by the procedural stuff, but I do actually have a question, because I want more information about how these drones are being used to prevent imminent destruction of evidence. Can somebody help me understand that?
So hopefully I can clear it up for you. Today, there isn't a provision in the statute that allows a drone to be used for that purpose. So the ask in this bill is to allow the use of a drone for situations where evidence would otherwise be destroyed while we wait for a search warrant to document it, right? So as I testified earlier, think about an outdoor crime scene. You want to be able to document where everything is specifically, but you know there's a big black cloud coming and it's going to be a thunderstorm in 10 minutes. Outside of this bill, our obligation as law enforcement to be able to launch that drone and document that scene would be to prepare a search warrant application, find a judge, ask a judge to review it, sign it, and get that search warrant back out to the investigators at the scene before they could use that drone to document that scene.
Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the explanation. I guess then I'm wondering how that runs into, and I genuinely don't know, this is not like a gotcha thing, but how that runs into the constitutionality of search and seizure, because there's a process for a reason, right, to get a search warrant, because you have to prove that there's a reason that you need that search warrant. And so I'm hesitant when looking at this, because you're saying, well, we can't wait for a search warrant, we're just going to fly a drone over and then search people. And, like, I feel like there are constitutional provisions that wouldn't allow that to happen. I don't know if that was a question or a statement.
Go ahead. Representative Hollins, I might add, or for clarification, documentation of evidence on, like, a fatal accident scene, for example, if there's weather involved, not necessarily rain, think of it as wind or snow. And you want to get documentation of the skid marks and something that's extremely easy to degrade.
you could get that drone up and get that picture. The skid marks would be, I think, blowing snow, how easy it would be to lose that evidence. So that's a situation that I know we've been concerned about it. A large area that you can't get a decent picture. You need that aerial picture from, used to use the helicopter to do that documentation. If that was in the winter, which is, a long time here, that's not necessarily something you could get at. Looks like Superintendent Evans might want to also chime in.
Chair Novotny and Representative Hollins, this is a good question. I think one of the challenges with a law like this is that when you ask about constitutionality, the Constitution would be an exception. It would be permissible to do that under that. Because we have a UAV law that's much more restrictive, we have to follow the UAV law, so we can't always rely upon the constitutional exception that would allow that to prevent the imminent destruction of property in that scenario for the documentation of utilization of the UAV. So this is where the way this law was crafted is like it's a very restrictive use of the UAV. So in that situation, even though it would be a constitutional exception to gather the evidence, which we do, if we think a thunderstorm's coming and blood is going to wash away, we do that in the scenario. But then we have to justify it and be very clear about why we didn't. And then we always follow up with a search warrant, et cetera. This situation, because it's a restrictive set of circumstances, it would allow that being put back into the statute.
Representative Holland.
I'm good.
All right. So in the rush to get all three bills into the order what we were going to do, I missed one of the testifiers. We have a Terry Nelson signed up from ACLU to testify.
Mr. Chair, I was going to follow up on something Representative Hollins asked, but I guess I suppose I'll save it for later. Permanent. All right, thanks.
You have to leave. You want to leave? Ms. Nelson, begin your. Yes, Representative or Ms. Nelson, begin your test. State your full name. Begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Teresa Nelson, and I am legal director for the ACLU of Minnesota. Thank you for the opportunity to talk with you today about drones and changes to the legislation. Minnesota laws regulating police use of drones were passed after many conversations and negotiations with law enforcement partners back in 2020. The bill or the law that's in place right now was crafted with a lot of the same concerns I'm hearing today in mind. I just want to remind folks that drones are a powerful tool. The technology is always evolving, and unlike helicopters and police vehicles, which do have practical limitations, as Mr. Evans noted, drones are cheap, small, and quiet. And because of that, they're particularly well-suited to secret surveillance, which is what led to the warrant requirement in the first place. Drone usage has rapidly increased in Minnesota. According to the BCA's reports, UAVs were used 4,326 times, and most of those were without the use of a warrant. And that's a 41% increase from the previous year. So considering those skyrocketing rates of usage, it's concerning that we're considering bills that would widen the exceptions of the statute. We don't oppose the usage of drones. We believe that there should be strong safeguards to ensure that these powerful tools are not used in a way that violates civil liberties protections. So I'm going to go through some of the concerns, some of the issues by bill, and then I will try to hopefully address the DE3 and the DEA3 amendments in a way that's coherent. First of all, with House File 561, we do have concerns with the language on lines 110 and 111. Subdivision 1 of the law already allows for warrantless drone usage in a situation where there's an ongoing search for a lost child or a vulnerable adult. When a child or vulnerable adult is missing, this is a classic example of what's described in the statute, which is an emergency situation that involves the risk of death or bodily harm to a person. I think we can all agree with that. And that language in Subdivision 1 was the result of extended negotiations with stakeholders. And while the final language encompasses emergencies beyond a missing child or a vulnerable adult, allowing the use of a drone to search for missing persons was exactly the type of emergency that was top of mind when this language was adopted. It certainly was for the ACLU. We don't need any additional language to facilitate warrantless drone usage when first responders are searching for a missing child or a missing person. And the problem with the new language is that there's no temporal limitations to it. It would allow for warrantless drone surveillance in situations when a person has been missing for months or years. And so that's just too broad of an exception. The exception that's already in there covers these kinds of emergencies when we're looking for a missing child, and we oppose changing that language. Again, House File 561, lines 2.1 to 2.2, we're very comfortable with the type of exception that is encompassed in this language. And it is, you know, the idea is similar to a fleeing suspect. Police, when somebody is suspected of a felony and police are in hot pursuit, they can enter a home without a warrant. The Supreme Court has recognized that. And so this is the kind of thing that has symmetry. All that said, we do recommend adding some qualifiers to more closely mirror Supreme Court precedent. Yes, sir.
Ms. Nelson, I'm going to ask if would it be possible for you to put a pause on your testimony. Superintendent Evans needs to leave, and Representative Pinto has a question for him quick.
Of course.
Could we get Superintendent up there? Could you step aside just for a second, and we can get Superintendent Evans up and so he can take care of his issue.
Thank you.
Once again, Superintendent, welcome back, Representative Pinto.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'll try to be as efficient here as possible. I just wanted to follow up on Representative Hollins' questions about the preventing imminent destruction of evidence, that language. As I understand what you're saying, the constitutional requirement is still in place. There has to be exigent circumstances in order to be able to not require a warrant, but you're saying that there's this current statutory requirement limiting the use of a UAV, even if you can get past that constitutional, the warrant requirement. But I guess if I combine those two, Superintendent, it feels like then we're only talking about situations where a UAV is the only way to keep to prevent the destruction of evidence. So the sheriff who answered the question earlier described, you know, there's stuff in, I guess it'd be like a backyard and a rainstorm is coming. Well, I mean, right now you can go into that backyard because if it's about to be destroyed, you can take pictures, do whatever you need to do. So I'm trying to think if there's a circumstance, this may be for you or for somebody else, but a circumstance where that clause would actually apply, you know, where you would need a UAV to be the thing that preserves or protect evidence from the imminent risk of destruction.
Superintendent.
Chair Novotny and Representative Pinto, I think that's a good question. I think what I think this scenario is allowing, I understand what you're asking. I don't think they should be viewed in exclusion. I agree we still have the scenario where you can go and collect the evidence. In outdoor scenes, especially large scenes, like where the BCA is assisting our partners and they're conducting their own crime scene examinations, the UAVs have been utilized on a regular basis. That's the main purpose of what the BCA has UAVs for example, is to be able to get that bird's eye view over the crime scene to provide the overview of that particular crime scene so that they can present that in court as it's being prepared. I think here, I don't know that it's the only scenario that it would, that in other words, that we could still go in and get the evidence, but I think you'd be prohibited from utilizing the UAV in that scenario to document the scene.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I'll have some follow-ups on that, but I don't know that I'll need you, Superintendent, for that. And so I want to be able to keep things on track, Chair, and we can get back to other points later.
Any other questions specifically for Superintendent Evans before he has to leave? Thank you, Superintendent Evans. Ms. Nelson?
Mr. Chair, I was saying we are comfortable with an exception that encompasses sort of the idea of a fleeing suspect. But that said, we do recommend qualifiers to more closely mirror what the Supreme Court has said, right? So the U.S. Supreme Court has recognized police can go in when they're chasing a suspect who is suspected of committing a felony. But the Supreme Court also, in Lange versus California, has rejected the idea that fleeing suspect rule is carte blanche when you're talking about pursuing somebody who's suspected of a misdemeanor. And so I would recommend qualifying language that we're talking about somebody who's fleeing for, you know, either a violent crime or who is fleeing from a felony or some other presents a risk of imminent harm. And then lines 2.3 to 2.5, I would say if the intention is to use a drone to pursue somebody who's actively escaping from a facility, a correctional facility, you know, that exception would probably be encompassed in the same exception as lines 2.1 and 2.2, right? It's a fleeing suspect, a fleeing person who is fleeing arrest. And so I would say it's superfluous and unnecessary. But if the intention is to use a warrantless drone to search for anybody who has absconded, regardless of the time limitations, mm-hmm. That's a really broad rule that could, you know, it's a broad exception that could swallow the rule, because at any given time there are hundreds of people who are considered, you know, fugitives from the Department of Corrections. Moving on to House File 1275, again, in terms of the language on pursuing somebody, we're concerned about the in risk of language in this bill, and I see that Drew Evans has the BCA has recommended a change to remove that language. And that would be good. But again, we suggest adding a qualifier to make sure that we're talking about pursuing fleeing felons, people suspected of a felony crime or a violent crime. And then House File 1396. So this is a little more complicated. I think I've spoken to everything, but I will say going from the DE3A amendment, I think this language on lines 1.4 and 1.5 is improved from the in risk of language, which could be really broad. But the language in House File 561 is much more precise. It is to locate a person sought for arrest when the person has fled from a law enforcement officer and a law enforcement officer remains in pursuit of that person. And that really encapsulates kind of the hot pursuit exception to the warrant requirement that the Supreme Court has recognized. The language on 1.9 to 1.21 in the DE3 amendment, again, that's probably superfluous language because it would be encompassed in the fleeing suspect exception. Line 2.3, we have no problem with that. We have no problem with using it for training with the consent of the owner. And line 2.8, again, for the same reasons that we object to adding a search for missing persons in Representative Quam's bill, we object to adding missing persons in line 2.8 of the DE3 amendment because it's already there in subdivision 1 of the statute. I would be happy to answer questions, and thank you for your time.
Thank you. We have one testifier signed up left, and that is Executive Director of the Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association, Jeff Potts.
Hey, Mr. Chair, thank you for allowing us the opportunity here. Jeff Potts, representing Minnesota Chiefs of Police, about 300 police chiefs in the state of Minnesota. Just real brief here, we do support House File 396 in its amended version. We support the provisions, particularly the ability to use it in private areas with written consent, facilitating the search for missing persons. We've heard about that here today. I will say that there are a number of agencies who have adopted UAV or drone programs, but many have not. That's largely due to costs and kind of navigating the current statute. We think these provisions will help. We think there is a good place for the use of UAVs in helping keep communities safe, and I think police departments across the state are interested. We, again, support the provisions in 1396 and look forward to working with the author and others to deal with some of the privacy concerns along the way here, but I just want to put our support behind the bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for allowing us to testify.
Thank you, Director Potts. I believe that is now the end of the testifiers. We'll go back to the top of the order just to give you a chance. Representative Hollins, are you? Do you have any questions? Nope. Yes?
Mr. Chair, can I defer to Representative Pinto?
Representative Pinto.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. So back to what I was asking Superintendent Evans about,
Representative Witte, I'd heard the sheriff say in response to the question from Representative Hollins, just describing a circumstance where you've got a, I don't know if he said backyard, but it was in my head anyway, where there's a rainstorm coming, right? And I guess I'm just, so I'm looking at the DE3, that line 1.7, I think the circumstances we're looking at are really limited where right now, because if there's stuff on the ground and you want to go get it, you can do that without a UAV. We're really just describing can you just describe the circumstances you have in mind for that line 1.7 now that you've heard some of the discussion?
Thank you, Chair Novotny. So I think what he's talking about is when they go to crime scenes, they can be big. They can be outside, they can be inside, they can be around the backyard, it can be down the road. And I think the UAV allows them to kind of have a different view from different ways and when you're trying to present the evidence. So you can't have above look, but you can bring it down to street level so you're watching. And I think it helps with the evidence of the crime scene that way. I'll give you an example. Back in when I was a Burnsville police officer, we had someone that was missing, Anna Ray Shunk. And we couldn't find her. It went on for many weeks. And there was a farm field just outside of Faribault where we did a triangulation. And we didn't have a helicopter, we didn't have drones, any of that, but it's a big field. And we just had people go walking out there. We missed it. And then probably about 3 days later, after they did the tilling of the thing, a farmer came driving by in his truck and found her body there. You get tips like that throughout this, and this just allows the ability of it. And I do think afterwards, I think what Drew Evans was, Commissioner Drew Evans was trying to explain is after you use it, you still file your subpoena, and if you don't have, or your warrant, if you don't have all the evidence, then it will be taken out. So I think that's what he's trying to do for like the element of time. To hopefully find some of the evidence in that. And I think that's the purpose of this. If something isn't going to be allowed in the court, I think that would be filed right after you do your warrant.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks. That's helpful, Representative Witte. And I guess it sounds like it seems to me that there may well be a gap to close here in what you're describing. I don't know that the language 1.7, it feel like it's a little too broad for what you're describing, but it may be as things move along that'd be something that I could imagine could be addressed. It sounds like the line 2.3 about the private area with the written consent of the occupant, that makes a lot of sense. I will say a lot of what Ms. Nelson had to say about kind of how broad the language is and some of the other clauses does cause me concern. And I guess I'll just note for myself, but hopefully other people find this useful too, like if you look at clause 8, lines 1.17 to 1.18, which you're not touching, it's just existing law. You know, right now, a drone can be used over any public area if there's a reasonable suspicion of criminal activity, which I think would cover just about everything else in here. So we really are just describing about circumstances involving each of our, you know, backyards, our private property, maybe right outside of our homes, you know, right outside of our bedroom or living room windows. There's certainly occasions where that's necessary. But so I want us to keep in mind as we would examine this to just the circumstances are not at all public property. It's entirely private property, like each of our private property. And so we want to be very, very careful about any additional exception we would add. So as I say, I think a couple of clauses here I could imagine could make sense, might need a bit of language changes. Other ones give me a lot of concern about how broad they are. I guess especially the missing person one, it makes a lot of sense to me, as Ms. Nelson pointed out, that if there's a risk of death or bodily harm, which is a very broad concept, that's already covered. If there's not one of those things, I'd want to make sure we have a really clearly narrow clause in there. So thank you for your work on it, and happy to have further conversation. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you. Chair Novotny and Representative Pinto, I welcome any discussion on this. Obviously, there's three bills we're trying to combine from different agencies that Representative Tapke, Representative Quam have brought forward, and whatever we can do to improve it. But I do reiterate that. I do think in cases like this, seconds, minutes matter. And more importantly, these are tools that can hopefully come to a good outcome and be utilized. And sometimes you don't know. We could play the what-if game, and you're not playing the what-if game, but we could do what-ifs on everything. And I just read a story where a Kansas trooper just stopped a car didn't know why they're stopping it just for a traffic violation, petty misdemeanor traffic violation, and inside the vehicle he recovered a missing kit. So you never know what situations you're getting into and all this, and from safety standpoints and that. So I like I said, I'm open to ideas and willing to listen more.
Representative Burt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is just, I don't know who the question's for. It's just kind of logistical. So as we're looking at expanding how drones can be used in law enforcement, first of all, in the use that's already happening, are the law enforcement officers also licensed drone pilots? And then the second part of that is this going to start to put sort of undue burdens on departments to then train and pay for law enforcement officers to get their drone pilot's license? I'm asking because my oldest son is a drone pilot, has his license from the FAA, does training, and actually does work for the city of Burnsville, et cetera. And so I kind of know a little bit about the uses that law enforcement might have, and I'm just wondering if your officers are actually licensed as well.
Sure, Pablo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, the answer is some police officers are licensed drone pilots. Mm-hmm. Some licensed police officers fly under what's called a certificate of authorization through the FAA. So it's sort of an exception to the rule for public safety purposes. There is a minimum standard of training to qualify and be issued that COA is what we call it. But oftentimes, even with a COA in place for an agency, one or more of the deputies and officers are oftentimes also licensed drone pilots through the FAA.
Representative Burt.
Okay, thank you. That is good to hear. I guess I'm just asking because we're spending a fair amount of time discussing the safety of this, and you know the administration has done some dismantling of the FAA, and it's a little scary out there in general right now. So just wanted to make sure that we're keeping safety top of mind. Thank you.
Response, Chair Pablo, or
you don't have to respond. I have none.
All right, Representative Feist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks, Representative Witte. I guess I just said thank you, but then I'm going to criticize your bill, so sorry. So I just like always have a very purist approach to like the use of technology for surveillance. So just my like my general instinct when I see expansions of surveillance is just get very nervous because we create this technology and we limit it, but then over time, you know, future legislatures like us, you know, can make different decisions about how we allow that use. And so I think a lot of the details have been covered. You know, Ms. Nelson has some good advice on where we can narrow different provisions. And I was on the board of the ACLU of Minnesota for a while, and Terry's amazing and brilliant. So I'm sure she'd be happy to work with you on that. And I would just say, like, high level, philosophically, I think when we look at the use of drones, our question shouldn't be what is more convenient, because, like, obviously it's much more convenient to use a drone than to have a bunch of people walk through a field. I think it should be, you know, how does this better protect public safety? What is the urgency that requires us to use a drone in this circumstance? And I think there are circumstances where that is the case, and I can be, like, understand the balance of considerations. And I feel like I'm not there on all of these provisions, but some of them, I think, with some narrowing language can serve public safety in a really important way. But I'm just always, always nervous and always think about, like it's not about convenience. It's about, like, why is this necessary to protect public safety in a way that we can't right now? So thanks.
Thank you.
Representative Steer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I have a question for Terry Nelson, if she's still here.
Ms. Nelson, go ahead.
So my question is that Subdivision 1 already says that police can use this in an emergency situation. I just think that the word emergency is very subjective, and there could be times where it's not necessarily an emergency, but it is a law enforcement call. A hypothetical would be a 10- or 12-year-old child in a farm decides he's going to run away or she's going to run away, and they go into a cornfield. Parents are scared, but is that an emergency? I think that's your view on that.
Mr.
Director
Chair.
Director Nelson.
Representative, I think that is potentially an emergency if the child is too small to be able to see in a cornfield. Yes, that is the kind of emergency that we are talking about when there's a child who's missing. I agree, it is somewhat subjective. The idea, though, is that when we think about a warrant requirement, the courts have recognized exceptions when there are emergency situations. And so that's where this idea comes from, is when there's an emergency, or they call it exigent circumstances, there's a different standard. And so that's where that language comes from.
Representative Steer.
I'm good, thank you.
Representative Coran.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representatives Witte, Tabke, and Quam, for the collective bill that we have. I just wanted to say, technology clearly it makes our conversations here in this committee a lot more delicate. We have that balance between safety and constitutionality, and I think we're all in a place where we want to be able to walk that line to the best of our ability. To me, there's no replacement for the interpersonal aspects of law enforcement that officers provide. But I do think it's worth seriously considering anytime technology can reduce safety risks to anyone. I'm just sort of like laying out where I'm at with you on this issue, is that I loudly and clearly hear the constitutionality concerns, and I think before we get to the place where we might pass something like this, we just want to be clear about some of those things. I'm on team, if we can have technology replace something that a person would otherwise have to risk their health or safety for, I think that's generally a good move, and I think that's what we're aiming to do here with this bill, both for law enforcement and for the people that law enforcement are serving and protecting, right? I sort of wanted to lay that out. And I also wanted to address, I know a couple of my colleagues talked about the imminent destruction of evidence. And it just sort of popped in my head, I don't know, not to talk about the details of this documentary, but if anyone watched Making a Murderer years ago, that crime scene was huge. There's acres large property, with tons of cars and trails that go over to this fire pit and that fire pit. And it's not unusual in some pretty awful homicides where there's kidnapping involved, that's the type of scene that you're working with. So in my mind, that's sort of what I go to, is when somebody's brought to a remote location and that person during the commission of their crime has accessed several areas on land that is expansive. And in order to tell that story best to a jury, you can get some really, really good aerial views to show people what that environment is like. And you just can't capture that, especially if there are large trees and you're trying to have a person walk the path of where a crime happened. It's really impossible to tell that story by taking a camera and just taking pictures. Just to me, that's kind of how I see it. I think that's the intention here too. And hopefully that helps paint a different picture for folks who maybe aren't quite seeing it that way. I expect we'll have more conversation on data privacy stuff and judiciary, so I'll hold it there. Thank you.
Response, Chair Witte, or Vice Chair Witte.
Thank you, Representative Curran. And yes, this is about safety. It's not just officer safety. It's a suspect safety and the community safety when something should happen out there, and being able to utilize your tools the best of your ability. So, and thank you. I mean, the crime scene that Making a Murder popped right into my head. That's a really good analogy. So thank you.
Representative Curran, if you like the in-person, if you like personal relationships, I do have space available for co-authors on my helicopter and plane bill for the State Patrol. Chair Mueller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, we are definitely, prepared to vote this out of committee, and also expecting that we can amend it. I think Director Nelson made some really good points about narrowing some of the language here, and I think line 1.7, the preservation of evidence, I didn't understand what that meant until we heard the testifiers, and so I think better reflecting what the testifier's intent is when the language of the bill will narrow it to capture the cases I think you're wanting to capture here. So look forward to continued discussions on this bill as it moves forward. Thank you.
Thank you. I remove my motion to recommend the House File 1396 as amended is re-referred to the Judiciary Committee. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, nay. Motion carries and House File 1396 as amended is re-referred to Judiciary. Thank you everyone for the work on this bill, especially the nonpartisan who's done numerous rewrites and work on the amendment. Next bill on the agenda is House File 1744. Representative Steer, please come to the testifier table with your testifiers.
Emotional support.
Representative Steer, would you like to move your bill before the committee with the recommendation is re-referred to the General Register?
That is my motion, Mr. Chair.
Representative Steer, you have a delete all amendment coded DE1 that incorporates the language changes on law enforcement authorized use of tracking devices that were made in Judiciary's committee to House File 7. Is that correct?
That is correct.
All right, well, we'll move the amendment. All in favor of adopting DE1 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say nay. Motion carries and the DE1 is adopted. Please begin your testimony and have your testifiers on the bill as amended.
All right, since the amendment is adopted, I won't cover that. So the passage of House File 1744 is a step in the right direction for taking back Minnesota roadways while protecting Minnesotans and visitors. I want to thank Chair Moeller and Chair Novotny for their commitment to public safety while also ensuring the guardrails are in place to strengthen public trust. With me today, I have Executive Director Jeff Potts as a testifier.
Director Potts, state your full name and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just here briefly to again, represent the Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association and to put our support behind this bill. I actually had thought about, geez, what can I say about this that this committee might not have already heard? And the previous bill, Representative Curran made some really profound statements that actually fit this bill as well. And the statement I heard was, you know, when we can use technology to keep people safe, as long as we can adapt and navigate the privacy concerns, I think it puts us all in a better place. And frankly, that's what this bill does. There's technology out there that if law enforcement were to be able to use it, can help keep police pursuits much safer than they currently are. As we know, pursuits are very dangerous. The speeds to other motorists, innocent bystanders along the roadway. Being able to use a tracking device when a vehicle flees, we think will help keep people safe. The police officers that are pursuing can back off and follow or kind of be aware of where the vehicle is going at much safer speeds. It creates a much, much safer situation for other motorists. We have met with Representative Scott to address and others to address some privacy concerns, and we're comfortable with the language that has been added regarding reporting and removal requirements. And we think this bill will definitely help police and law enforcement deal with pursuits by being able to deploy these tracking devices to help track where that vehicle is going. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for allowing us to testify.
Thank you. There are no other testifiers signed up. Is there any questions for the testifiers or Representative Steer? Representative Feist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to thank you, Representative Steer, for working so hard to create some additional guardrails and parameters around this expansion of this technology. Like I said on the previous bill, I always am very nervous about expanding use of surveillance technology, but I appreciate all the work you did to make this a really narrowly tailored, thoughtful exception. So thank you.
Chair Mueller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Steer. I also very much appreciate your hard work on this bill and trying to bring a couple of different bills together and add those guardrails. So I'm looking forward to supporting it today. Thank you.
With that, I renew my motion to House File 1744 as amended is recommended to be re-referred to the General Register. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say nay. Motion carries and House File 1744 as amended is re-referred to the General Register.
I feel like the
next
luckiest man
bill on the agenda is House File 1375, Representative Duran.
I should get the lottery ticket. Do I have to bring them to everyone?
Representative Duran, Bill House File 1375. You want to move the bill before the committee?
Yes, Chair.
Please begin your testimony and have your testifier state their name for the record and begin their testimony.
Mr. Chair, committee, thank you for allowing me to speak to you in regards to House File 1375, which was brought to me by the Minnesota Police and Peace Officers Association. It addresses the arbitration selection process that was changed in 2020. The result of the change has been that law enforcement officers fall under a different system in which challenges unfair discipline than every other public employee in the state of Minnesota. Other law enforcement officers should be treated fairly and have the same rights as every other public employee. Under the prior system, the selection of arbitrators came from a pool of experienced individuals, limiting arbitrators and a police just only to a police panel so that they're only able to hear law enforcement discipline cases, has resulted in situations where the forces to have their cases heard and by inexperienced arbitrators. With that, today I have several individuals who are here to help me out, and I will start over here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name
please
is
Please state your full name before you get in here.
Jim Michaels. I'm a labor attorney. I represent public employee unions. Only a portion of them are law enforcement unions. Many of them represent firefighters, and many of them represent employees who are not in either public safety fields. I'm here today to testify on this bill because this is a fundamental fairness issue, and it's a labor issue. This is not a police issue. It's a labor issue. Since its inception in the 1970s, PELRA has mandated that collective bargaining agreements for public employees contain a clause with a grievance procedure that provides for compulsory and binding arbitration of grievances, including discipline. That's supported by the United States Constitution, which considers public employment a property right that's subject to the due process requirements of the Fourth Amendment. So what is due process? Well, there's really kind of three elements to that. The first is that there is a fair and unbiased adjudication of disputes. Second, when it comes to discipline, due process would suggest that an accused individual is innocent until proven guilty. It's the same in the employment sphere as it is in our criminal justice system. And the third element is that the party who is bringing the charges bears the burden of proof. So that's really kind of the fundamental principles of what due process really is. Now, the arbitrator in an arbitration system is really not only entrusted with adjudicating, but it's also their role to be the one that ensures that the due process that's afforded to the employee is fair. And in order to be able to fulfill that role, arbitrators have to be trained and experienced and unbiased. You know, as the author of the bill introduced, the change to the system that carved out a different system for law enforcement officers was done in the aftermath of George Floyd's death, among many other things that the legislature undertook at that time. And I have no question in my mind that some of these efforts were clearly well-informed. But I think it's important to consider, as we sit here today, what some of the aftermath has been and whether it really has improved the system at all. What I would say is that there have been two fundamental changes that treats our law enforcement officers different from other public employees. The first one is how arbitrators are assigned to a case. For every other public employee in the state of Minnesota, if their grievance is going to be heard by an arbitrator, they get a roster, they go to the Bureau of Mediation Services roster. The commissioner will send them a list of seven arbitrators. Management gets to strike three names. The union gets to strike three names. The last arbitrator standing is the one that will hear the case. That's not so with the police disciplinary panel. It's limited to six arbitrators, and they are assigned to hear a case. So that's the first fundamental difference, is that the officer and the officer's representative has no ability to participate in the decision-making as to who their arbitrator is. The second one, and this is the far more important one, is the process by which one gets to be an arbitrator. For the general BMS arbitration panel, the arbitrator or arbitrator-to-be has to apply with the Commissioner of Bureau of Mediation Services. They are vetted. They go through a process to determine their ability to hear cases and to adjudicate them fairly. And before they're actually allowed to arbitrate cases, they go through almost like an internship process where they sit with other arbitrators, watch them handle cases, not only how they conduct the case, how they rule on evidentiary matters and questions that come before them, and ultimately how they render their decisions. And before I turn it over to my colleagues to speak more about this bill, I would just ask, in your own mind, if you can kind of square this circle. We have a system right now in Minnesota where let's say that there are two employees of the same city. There is a firefighter and there is a police officer. Both of them are charged together for violating the city's policy, which says you cannot appear in a political advertisement while you are wearing your uniform. The employer moves to terminate both employees. Their respective unions file a grievance on the grounds, not that they necessarily violated the policy, but really whether the discipline that was imposed is too severe under the circumstances. The firefighter, with her union, has the ability to select an arbitrator from a group of seven people and to have somebody who's been vetted by the commissioner of BMS, presumably has tried multiple cases, and if they hadn't, they could be stricken by that union. The law enforcement officer, on the other hand, has no determination of who their arbitrator is and has no assurances that that arbitrator has the ability to conduct a fair hearing. So, I in my mind, can't reconcile why those two employees who did the exact same thing, or at least are accused of doing the exact same thing, should not have the exact same process to determine their fate. And with that, I'll turn it over to my colleagues. Thank you.
Mr. Beck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Kevin Beck. I am also an attorney in private practice. I represent labor unions in both the private and the public sector. Just to piggyback on what Mr. Michaels said, there are minimum qualifications to become a labor arbitrator in the state of Minnesota, and they're set forth in Minnesota Rule 5530.0600, subpart 4. To become a labor arbitrator, you have to demonstrate your qualifications, and there's six ways you can do that. That's for what I call the regular roster. For the police officer grievance arbitration roster, those are not required. You don't need to provide any minimum qualifications. You just have to do two training requirements in 626, which is outside of PELRA. To become a regular roster arbitrator, you have to have effectively experience in labor arbitration, either as a labor arbitrator authoring decisions, hearing cases, running hearings, or as an advocate for either management or a union. Those don't apply, and that is a problem for the people who are placed on this roster, and more importantly, for the people who go in front of them, the advocates, the employees, and management for that matter. We have in Minnesota a pool, as the committee member referenced, of highly qualified, highly respected labor arbitrators. They are prohibited under the current law from hearing police officer discipline cases because you can only go on one roster, the regular roster or the peace officer roster. And the practical reality is that the vast majority of cases fall under the what I call the regular roster, the non-police discipline roster. And so if an arbitrator who gets paid for their time has to choose between those, they're going to pick the regular roster. So we kneecap ourselves from these highly qualified, well-respected, not just in the state of Minnesota, but in the country and internationally, they're not allowed to hear these cases. Perversely, they are allowed to train the people that hear cases under POGAR. So we trust them to train the POGAR roster. We don't trust them to hear the cases. That's a problem. So I will cede the rest of my time and hand it over to Mr. Schneider.
Thank you.
Mr. Schneider, go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Novotny. Good afternoon, members of the committee. My name is Mark Schneider. I'm an attorney at Law Enforcement Labor Services. As part of my duties with Law Enforcement Labor Services, I'm entrusted to ensure due process rights for licensed peace officers, correctional officers, other non-licensed and public safety employees. Why we're here today, obviously, is to discuss, after 4 years under the POGAR statute, and that's the peace officer arbitration statute that we're talking about, we now anecdotally know, number one, was it necessary? Number two, is it working? And number three, how can we proceed to ensure due process? And I know there are several attorneys and other individuals on this committee who have been trained in and understand and have talked about due process and what process is due. But as we know anecdotally now, over the last 4 years in handling arbitrations, and I know as part of the materials that we've submitted for the committee's consideration are statistics, I believe, from Law Enforcement Labor Services from 2020 to 2024. But importantly, unions play a gatekeeping role, in determining how to proceed with grievances. Nobody here in this room is here to keep bad cops in their jobs. And I know that was the narrative several years ago, or the concern that was voiced. That's not our role. Our role is to ensure that officers and other public employees' rights are protected not only under PELRA, the Public Employee Labor Relations Act, but under the Collective Bargaining Agreement and other statutes and rules in the state of Minnesota. And as Mr. Beck pointed out, what we're confronted with right now is a limitation on individuals who are assigned to the roster of six under POGAR. And those individuals either are trained by the standard or the regular arbitrators through Bureau of Mediation Services, and yet those same arbitrators are precluded from being part of the peace officer arbitration process. Also, the vetting of individuals on the six-person roster is limited. As we know, the statute talks about BMS and the commissioner of BMS may consider the factors under the rules. But if you look at the rule, it talks about the mandatory use and review of those factors by the commissioner when assigning an arbitrator for the general roster. And that is a concern, not only because of the specialty of peace officers and what they do, but quite frankly, to ensure that public employers are acting properly, number two, and most importantly, that the public safety is guaranteed. And again, we're not up here as sour grapes. That statute was enacted for a reason, and rightfully so. But I think what we need to do is take a step back here today and review whether it's working. And if it's not working, why not? There were safeguards in place before the enactment of this statute. And specifically, as you can see from the statistics and the information we provided, over 600 complaints were issued against officers in the state of Minnesota between 2016 and 2020. Of those, only 8 proceeded to arbitration. And the arbitrators in those cases and in subsequent cases consider whether or not the employer has met their burden of proof, whether there was an adequate investigation, and whether or not there was just cause to support the discipline, termination, discharge, suspension, etc. And that's really the nuts and bolts of the property interest of public employees, to ensure that their career, their chosen profession, if they messed up, they should pay the price. But we want to make sure that they're treated fairly, that there's a full and fair review by an independent fact finder and decision maker. And what we have in place through the Bureau of Mediation Services, with the ability to strike arbitrators, for them to fully vet arbitrators, and to ensure public safety, we should go back to the old system or take advantage of the safeguards that were in place then. And with that, I'll turn over.
Thank you, Mr. Schneider. Next up, we have Scott Neal, Edina City Manager. Mr. Neal, state your full name, begin your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Novotny, Chair Mueller, and members of the committee. My name is Scott Neal. I'm the city manager of Edina, and I'm here to testify today on behalf of the League of Minnesota Cities to state my opposition to House File 1375, which would repeal the Peace Officer Grievance Arbitration Selection Procedure from state statute. The Grievance Arbitration Selection Procedure was passed into law in June of 2020 and has been a success from the perspective of cities across the state. It has created parity in the assignment of arbitrators and has increased the overall integrity of the process. We support the current statute, which requires the Commissioner of the Bureau of Mediation Services, in consultation with the community and law enforcement stakeholders, to appoint a roster of qualified, knowledgeable arbitrators to decide whether disciplinary action was appropriate or not. Removing the ability of the employer, the employee, or the employee's union to pick and choose arbitrators has been a welcome and needed change to the process. Arbitrators appointed by the commissioner must be qualified through both experience and training, specifically for peace officer grievance arbitrations. Arbitrators on the roster hear only peace officer grievances, allowing them the opportunity to hear all facts, maintain consistency in awards, and remain neutral in the process. When a grievance is filed, the arbitration process must be seen as a neutral and not favoring either party. Current statute upholds this standard, and repealing it would be a step backwards from that goal. I will note that the League was initially skeptical in the original legislation in 2020 as it was making its way through the process, but now has come to see the importance of the creation of a neutral, unbiased selection process. For these reasons, we do not support repealing the grievance arbitration selection procedure as proposed in House File 1375, and I'm happy to stand for questions. Thank you.
The last testifier we have is Executive Director Potts. Director Potts, state your full name again and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jeff Potts, again, representing the Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association, which is roughly 300 and some police chiefs across the state, about 150 command staff members as well. We are here also, similar to the previous testifier, to oppose the bill. But the reason is, and we agree with some of the earlier testifiers, that police discipline really should be about fairness. It should also be about accountability. And we believe it would be a mistake to go back to what we call the old system. And I think it was also mentioned that we got here for a reason in terms of the 2020 legislation. And I'll try to characterize for you what that reason was, at least from the Chiefs Association, or largely the employer's position. And that was that that the cases that went before arbitrators, it was already mentioned that there was a process where you could strike arbitrators, which led to sort of a perverse incentive for arbitrators to have a 50-50 record of who they or how they would rule on their cases. And our position on that was is that sometimes that took away from them ruling solely and specifically on the merits of the case. They oftentimes would get struck if their record was overly weighted in one side or the other. And so this bill came forward to provide what we thought was fairness, a neutral group of arbitrators, and then there's six of them. And I think the data was already presented, but since 2020, 43 cases have been referred to the Bureau of Mediation Services for police arbitration. 29 of those cases were mutually agreed to and settled prior to arbitration. 8 of those went before arbitrators. 6 of them, those cases were upheld. In 2 of those, the data is not public, which would indicate that they were not upheld and ruled in favor of the employee. Now, certainly that's not a 50-50 record, 6 and 2. But I don't believe that that means that the system is flawed. Now, I'm not saying that we can't improve the system. There may be work, and I look forward to conversations with our friends from the MPPOA and other law enforcement groups to find ways to improve the process. But I think from the Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association, we firmly believe that it would be a mistake to go back to the old system. Mr. Chair, thanks for the time and opportunity to testify here today.
Thank you, Director Potts. Any questions for Representatives Duran? Let's make sure we covered all the testifiers. All right. Chair Moeller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Duran, for your work on this. I know we've had conversations about it, and you know, I think we've got some discomfort on this side of the aisle because these were really hard-fought changes after George Floyd was murdered. And I think the solution, the testimony was really helpful, I will say, from everybody that was testifying today. And I think the thing we're concerned about is this is just a complete repeal and going back to the old way. And those of us that were on the legislature at the time when George Floyd was murdered and all of these discussions were happening, you know, can still remember some of that testimony about how that was some of the problems with the old system. So I appreciate that we're laying this over. I think this is something that we should continue to work on and discuss, but we're just not comfortable voting it out of committee today. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Duran, closing comments?
We're open to working with everybody and making sure that this thing gets by and make sure that everybody has a good feeling about it. So thank you very much.
And with that, House File 1375 is laid over. Thank you, Representative Duran, to you and your testifiers. You can remain at the table because your bill is also next. House File 2525, Representative Duran, would you like to move House File 2525 before the committee?
Yes, Chair.
Representative Duran, please explain your bill and have your testifier provide testimony on the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members, for allowing me to speak to you on the House File 2525. This bill would fund hearing protection for first responders. Funding an active hearing protection pilot program for the first responders in law enforcement is critical to safeguarding health, effectiveness, and long-term well-being of our law enforcement officers. Noise exposure is a significant occupational hazard, with 71% of law enforcement self-reporting hearing loss, far exceeding the national average. Noise-induced hearing loss is a common medical issue that can be developed over time from a single exposure, leading to permanent damage and increased to the risk of medical issues. Active hearing protection devices provide a crucial solution by filtering harmful noise while allowing officers to maintain situational awareness, enhancing mission readiness, safety, and survivability. Studies indicate that officers' primary concern about hearing protection is maintaining awareness of their surroundings in an issue where these devices effectively address. Additionally, investing in hearing protection can result in significant cost savings and reducing hearing-related injuries and disability claims. And by there, I will pass it off to the testifier.
Mr. Titus, state your full name and begin your testimony.
David Titus, chair, committee members. I am the deputy director of the MPPOA. I have not testified before you this session. And after listening to the testimony of the MPPA testifiers on the last bill, you're probably thinking they reached down to the minors, and you would be right. But for good reason. I was a 30-year cop in St. Paul. 8 years of that was on SWAT. And if you go back in time 30 years, technology and ear protection, and specifically, was not necessarily all that much of a priority. Matter of fact, we used to use used casings in our ears until we found out that that was a bad idea. So there are members on this committee that I know, and I won't rat them out, that do have a level of hearing loss due to our job. Yes, Chair.
I'm right here.
Okay, sorry. with all true sincerity, unlike traditional hearing protection, active hearing protection allows for officers to maintain situational awareness while reducing harmful noise levels. This is crucial in high-risk environments where clear communication and auditory perception can be a matter of life and death. Let me give you that life example, that real example. SWAT teams typically, most teams will already have something similar to this. Not this exact product, but something over, and they can hear the radio, but they can also hear what's going on beyond them. As you can imagine, I must underscore, situational awareness while having hearing protection is crucial. Now, where would this be greatly impactful? The street cop or the firefighter, right? We're out on the street, something's going on, and all of a sudden we have to put these in because it's a critical incident, but yet I still need to know what my partner is saying on the other corner of the house. I have to be aware. I have to be alert. What did we do in my day and everybody else who was a law enforcement officer on this committee in their day? We just didn't wear hearing protection. We didn't wear it. Well, then before you know it, we have breachers, which are plaster rounds, going into the door, which are as loud as a shotgun, right next to your ear. This would be key. The program establishes and creates Public Safety Officer Hearing Protection Program under the Minnesota Department of Public Safety. The eligible recipients will be peace officers, firefighters, qualified emergency medical service providers. Hearing protection products must be commercial, multi-use, and in scale and size, or in the canal style. They must have specifics to their noise reduction and designed to allow communication. That is key. The MPPA wholeheartedly hopes that you will support this measure in order to protect our hearing, our future cops' hearing, as they proceed through their careers. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for Representative Duran or the testifier? Closing comments, Representative Duran.
Well, by now, most of you probably know that I have the bionic ears as well, so I actually have hearing protection. Hearing aids from all the stuff that I've done, either in the Marine Corps or in law enforcement. So this is really crucial, I think, for making sure that we actually keep and maintain our officers' situational awareness, but not only that, but their safety and well-being and their support to our community. So this is a good bill here to help lead into that, and I hope for everybody's support on this. So thank you.
Thank you. And with that, House File 2525 is laid over. Last bill on the agenda today is House File 104. Vice Chair Feist, please come to the table with your testifier. Vice Chair Feist, I understand you would like to lay your bill over today.
Yes, Mr. Chair, the Senate had some technical input, and so we're going to take that and amend it onto the bill once we have it.
Thank you for that. And would you like to move your bill before the committee?
Yeah. I'm so sorry, I didn't hear what you said.
Would you like to move your bill before the committee?
Oh, yes, I would like to move my bill before the committee.
Vice Chair Feist, please explain your bill and have your testifier state her name for the record, providing testimony on this bill.
Great. Thank you so much, Mr. Chair. Thank you, committee. I'd like to first thank the advocates for victims, the system leaders who have worked so closely with me to develop this bill. Under this legislation, statements made in the context of a restorative practice setting would be inadmissible in court, similar to the privilege that exists for alternative dispute resolution. It is equally important to the success of a restorative practice as it is for alternative dispute resolution for there to be a legally safe space for dialogue so that an offender can accept responsibility for their actions without the possibility of their open, honest statements being used against them in another context. I want to emphasize that this bill does not interfere with the traditional legal mechanisms for holding offenders accountable. Prosecutors can simultaneously or at a later date bring offenders to justice, regardless of whether a victim chooses to explore a restorative pathway to accountability. Also, I would like to emphasize that this bill carves out important exceptions so that information can be shared when necessary to protect public safety. And one of the things that I've amended in already was based on input from Representative Hudson and Representative Steer to make sure that we're accounting for mandated reporters. And my testifier today will describe how the traditional legal system really has gaping holes in ensuring accountability. And that is what this bill seeks to address. And lastly, I just want to thank my Republican colleagues for working with me on this, for being open to discussing kind of a new way to look at accountability. And I just hope that I can also emulate that openness to learning new things. And I just really appreciate your collaboration. So thank you. And I will turn it over to the expert.
Please state your full name and begin your testimony.
Yes, my name is Sarah Super. And in 2015, I had an ex-boyfriend who broke into my apartment and raped me at knife point. He was arrested that night, successfully prosecuted in Ramsey County, and sentenced to 12 years in prison. He's part of the 3% of rapists who are ever held accountable for this crime. 97% of rapists walk free. With the validation of the court system, I was free to tell my story publicly. And by doing so, I heard from more than 1,000 other victims from across Minnesota who shared with me their story. In line with national statistics, more than half of them had chosen not to report. And the ones that had almost never seen justice done by the legal system. In 2017, I tried to increase the number of prosecutions by eliminating the statute of limitations for sex crimes, which we successfully did here in Minnesota with bipartisan support. Today, survivors are asking for another choice, and that is to have the option of a restorative practice. Just as filing a police report does not mean you'll have a conviction, seeking a restorative practice does not mean you'll have a dialogue or an apology. But having the choice is healing, and especially after a situation where you've been rendered powerless. I'm here on behalf of survivors who did not receive justice. And I'm appreciative of all the conversations I've had with people on this committee who've been very compassionate, not just in holding and hearing my own story, but also in allowing me to share others. So thank you so much for considering House File 104.
Thank you. There are two amendments to the bill. I understand we will only be taking up the A2 amendment. Vice Chair Feist, is that your amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chair, the A2 amendment is my amendment.
Please explain your amendment.
Yep, thank you, Mr. Chair. This is something I worked on with Representative Hudson. We wanted to enhance the existing reporting requirements for the Office of Restorative Practices to just create some additional parameters to ensure that as we're transitioning to a system where we have more access to restorative practices, that we are looking at the impacts that that's having on the system, on public safety, on victims, and just looking at the connection between the investments that counties and nonprofits are making in those restorative practices and how that impacts public safety recidivism. And so that is the A2 amendment.
Thank you. All in favor of adopting the A2 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, say nay. Motion carries and the A2 amendment is adopted. Are there any questions for Vice Chair Feist or her testimony? Testifier. Chair Mueller. Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I'm embarrassed to say I haven't looked this over very closely, but I assume that when we are talking about sex assault, we're talking about any version, right? I mean, so Ms. Super described like a very high level traumatic sort of situation, but when we're looking at this, you know, sexual assault can be anything. I mean, it can be, right? It can be like an unwanted touching by a boss, all the way up to a rape at knife point. And so I'm assuming this would apply to anything across those parts.
Yeah. Yes, I'll let you.
It does. But I think an important...
Ms. Super.
Thank you. An important thing to note is that a restorative practice is voluntary by all parties. So this would be something that the victim wants, and they could choose it in addition to also pursuing a legal pathway. In my case, I'll just share that I wouldn't have pursued restorative practices in lieu of the legal system. I'm very grateful that the legal system was there and offered me the sense of protection and justice I needed. But I have heard from so many others that didn't receive that in those cases where they file a report and nothing happens, they still need some form of justice, but people aren't willing to take accountability, even at just a community level, for fear of having that information brought into the legal courts.
Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that. I really appreciate it. And I know you and I connected in the hallway, and I told you that I had an experience where I was assaulted, and that person actually came back to me and apologized later and said, like, I just realized what I had done to you a year ago was probably totally inappropriate. And that apology went a really long way to repairing how I felt about situations and how I could trust people. And so I actually am fully in support of this. I think it's a really good idea. And it's a yes and, right? Like, it's sometimes you go the legal route, but also having those real conversations and having people understand how what they have done has impacted you as a human being, not just how it impacts the legal system, is important, because it's not just about creating punishments for people. It's about trying to get those people to be better human beings and understand how their actions have repercussions. And so that's what I see restorative practices as being a part of. So thank you. I really appreciate this bill.
Thank you.
Vice Chair Feist's response.
All of that. Yes, that's what we're trying to achieve here.
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Feist. It's been quite the journey, quite the adventure in trying to make this bill work. I just want to say this is kind of a leap of faith for me, and I think it is for a lot of folks on our side, simply because it's hard to contemplate, and maybe it's the dude in me, I don't know, but it's hard to contemplate being satisfied with somebody taking accountability but not facing punishment. I think the way I've reconciled that in my own head is that because the agency still lies with the victim, they have a choice of path of what's going to work for them. If they weren't going to pursue a criminal justice path anyway, then this provides them with something else that they can do to try to deal with the situation. It's not a path I would choose. It's not a path you chose. But providing some path for people to work things out, let's give it a try and read those reports nice and close and see if we can make adjustments in the future if need to be. Thank you.
Chair Mueller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you so much, Representative Feist, for your work on this, working really fiercely to hopefully we'll get it across the finish line this year. I also want to thank Sarah Super for your testimony and also your fierce advocacy over the years. And I just, because we have an extra minute, I want to just take time to acknowledge the work you did on the Memorial to Survivors of Sexual Violence that's on Boom Island. And so if anybody wants to visit that memorial, it is a beautiful memorial in a wonderful space, and I highly recommend that members of the committee and any members of the public who hasn't been, have not been able to go yet, take the opportunity to go visit that. So I'm looking forward to voting for this bill when we do. and thanks again. Thank you too, Mr. Chair.
Vice Chair Feist, closing remarks.
Thank you for the discussion today. This is a really good bill. It's going to create additional options while not foreclosing others. I again just want to thank my colleagues for working with me on this. You've taken a leap of faith in this bill, and I want to reciprocate. So, you know, that's how this place works. As we build relationships, we build trust, and we work together. And I think that it's really perfect that a bill about restorative practices was handled in a restorative, collaborative way. So I thank you all for your support and look forward to voting for this once we have those technical amendment from the Senate.
All right. With that, House File 104, as amended, is laid over. Thank you, Vice Chair Feist, and to your testifier for making the trip. We are holding an extra committee meeting this Friday, March 28th at 9 a.m. in this room, 120, for the agencies in the Public Safety Committee's jurisdiction to present their budget recommendations. There being no further business before the community today, the meeting is adjourned.